This conversation between Walter Langford and Harvey Haddix is being taped in Harvey's home in South Vienna, Ohio, on July 3rd, 1987. Harvey, you tell me you were raised right around here and came back here, and now tell me when and where you got started in baseball.
Well, actually, I got started right here in baseball. I played all my life in a little school over here in the next county, Champaign County, north of here.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a freshman in high school, we moved right down here about a mile down the road, and I finished my high school career here in Clark County at South Vienna. Catawba was the name of the high school.
Yeah.
And my last year of high school, after I graduated, I was playing semi-pro ball around the area here. And a fellow by the name of Pat Donahue came up to me after a game that I'd pitched, and he says, "I'm going to write to Connie Mack about you."
Mm-hmm.
Write, now not call. In those days, they wrote.
Yeah.
This was 1943.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't hear back from him, but in the meantime, I picked up the newspaper one day, and I saw a little note in there that said, "For the St. Louis Cardinals, we're having a tryout camp in Columbus, Ohio,"
mm-hmm.
which is 30 miles east of here.
Right.
So I said to my dad, I said, "I'd like to go over there and see what those scouts think of me." We went over there, and it was a three-day camp with 350 kids with two fellows running the camp. So you can imagine how busy.
Yeah, a madhouse.
Well, anyway, on my card that I filled out, that they for position, I put down pitcher, first baseman, outfielder, which I played all three positions at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they didn't have time for all that foolishness, so they just wiped out the last two, and they said, "You're a pitcher." And the first day there, we went from 9 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. When he finally called me in, he said, "Now you throw nothing but fastballs." So I threw fastballs, about 7 or 8, and he said, "Is that enough?" Or, "That's enough." He said, "You can come back tomorrow." I said, "Yes." We went back the next day, and it was the very same thing, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Now you throw what the catcher calls." And I threw probably 4 or 5 fastballs again, and I probably threw 4 or 5 curveballs, and he says, "That's enough. Do you want to sign?"
Wow.
And I said, "No." At the time, mm-hmm. I'm the old country boy, the honest boy. I'm giving this Pat Donahue from my hometown here the chance to sign me.
That's right.
Well, I never did hear back from Pat Donahue, so I went back over to Columbus and signed up with the St. Louis Cardinals.
That was 45?
1943.
43?
Yes.
Now, where did you go in the following years in the minors?
In the following years, of course, that was the war years.
Oh,
I made
a two-week
road trip with the Columbus Redbirds,
uh-huh.
who was in the Cardinal organization at that time.
I know.
And I came home and registered for the draft, and I was frozen on the farm for 1944, 45, and 46. After the war, I took off and went to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And
What classification was that, eh?
That was a Class C league
in
those days. In fact, they had D, C,
that's right.
B, A, AA, AAA, and Major Leagues in those days.
Yeah. All right, and after Winston-Salem, where else were you in the minors before you reached the Cards?
Well, it was quite a jump. I jumped from C-ball to AAA ball. I came right over here to Columbus, Ohio, where I originally was scouted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a struggle the first year. I think my first year there I was 11-9 or something like that, and it was a struggle. It was a learning process is what it was.
Yeah.
And I pitched there the next 2 years. I was there in 1948, 49, and 50.
Mm-hmm.
And before the 50 season, we were in the playoffs for the Little World Series
right.
at that time.
Right.
And Uncle Sam grabbed me for the Korean War.
Again?
Yes. And so I went with Uncle Sam this time. And I was gone from the end of the 1950 season till August of 1952 when I joined the St. Louis Cardinals. I came out of the Army and went right to the St. Louis Cardinals.
Right. You were shortchanged those few years, which is too bad.
Well, it's one of those things that happens.
A lot of ball players missed that number of years, and like Ted Williams missed, I think, most of six seasons.
Yeah, so some people are a little bit more fortunate than others.
Yeah. Now, besides the fastball and curve, did you have, when you came up, any other pitch?
At that time, I threw an off-speed pitch, yes, a change of pace, so-called. But while I was in Columbus here, one day after a ball game, one of the opposing players came to me and he said, "When did you start throwing a slider?" Uh-huh. Which was almost unheard of in those days.
Very new,
Well, I didn't know that I threw a slider, so I didn't say anything. And I started checking, and I found out as I was pitching that when I got a little tired, instead of staying on top of the ball, I was a little bit off the side of it and made the ball slide, and that wound up being a pretty good pitch for me because then I knew what I was doing with it.
Yeah. All right. How about your first game?
The first game in the major leagues, first game in the major leagues was against the Boston Braves and Lou Burdett was the opposing pitcher. I won that ball game 9-2.
Wow.
It came, it rained us out in the top of the ninth inning, I believe. And they finally called the game as one of those downpours in St. Louis where it just didn't quit.
Didn't stop.
And I can remember that game very well. My first time at bat off of Lou Burdett, I had a base hit with two RBIs.
Wow.
And a stolen base. And, of course, I knew it wasn't going to be that easy all the time.
That's right. Well, the first year, in fact, your first 3 years or so with the Cardinals, Eddie Stanky was the manager.
Yes, he was.
How'd you like Eddie?
Eddie was a little bit tough on the ball players.
That's what I hear.
He was a very smart baseball manager.
Yes, sir, he was.
But he was very, very tough on some of the ball players. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of guys learned a lot from him, and yet there was a few guys that he scared to death. So
that kind of manager can do that.
Yes.
All right, you came in, you were in third place that season. The next season, 53, was your best season from the won and lost.
Yes, sure was.
What do you got to say about that?
Well, all I can say is that it was all new to me. Mm-hmm. It was very exciting.
Sure.
I didn't worry about who I was pitching against. It didn't matter to me. In those days, we didn't go over the hitters much or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You just went out there and pitched. And evidently, I had good enough stuff that it didn't matter. Of course, you learned as you went along what guys' weaknesses were. My catcher most of that season was Del Rice, who had been there a while, so he knew a lot of the weaknesses, of course, with the hitters.
True enough. Okay. 54, they dropped back to sixth, and were 25 games back first place. What happened? You had a pretty good lineup in 54. In 54, seems to me.
Well, we had almost the same ballpark.
Yeah.
But
not quite. Joe Cunningham came at first, but you had Shane Deans and a bunch of others, and Stan Musial and Wally Moon and Rapalski.
I'm not sure whether that was Bill Verdon's first year, maybe then,
no,
too.
No, 54 was still Stanky.
No, he came the next year.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Bill Verdon came the next year. But I don't know what happened there. It was just one of those things that we just couldn't get going. And I was going, as a pitcher myself, I was going for my 13th win on the first day of July in 1954.
You want to get that phone?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I was going for my 13th win on the first day of July. And about a week before that, Al Brazel, who was a left-handed pitcher with us, had mentioned to me, he said, "You're going to win 30 ball games this year." And I felt like I could.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you don't count your eggs before they're hatched.
Not in baseball.
Well, anyway, I was in Milwaukee again. And believe it or not, of all the things that have happened, I was leading 4-1 in the fourth inning, and Joe Adcock hit a line drive back and hit me on my left knee and put me out. And of course, I didn't win that ball game.
Yeah.
And when I came back to try to pitch, the spring was gone out of my left leg. I had no spring to push off, and I never, ever threw the same after.
Well, that shows in your statistics. There's that drop off, and I wondered exactly what happened.
I never had the same spring off of that leg that I'd had before.
Did you lose some of your fastball?
Well, I lost a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
My control a little bit, and stamina, everything. Uh-huh. In fact, when I started pitching, I got the drop foot. It had ruined the nerves in that leg from the knee down.
Yeah.
And when it would get irritated from working, my foot would drop, and then I would tear the ligaments on top of my instep. So that was one of those things.
Yeah, I'll say. That's an occupational hazard with the pitchers is
line drives
banging you up.
Right.
Yep. Okay, then in that season too, Harry Walker took over during the season as manager. How was he as manager?
Harry was an excellent guy to try to teach things.
Mm-hmm.
As a manager, it was a very tough situation. You had a bunch of fellows there that had played with him. And of course, that didn't make it any easier for Harry to manage.
That's right.
By being a player with some of those guys. So it was really a struggle.
Yeah, lots of guys like Phil Cavaretta found out that taking over as manager with the same guys you played with.
It's a very tough situation, so it did not work out very good.
Mm-hmm. All right, now then, in 56, you got traded to Philly.
Yes.
Who'd they trade for?
In May the 11th, 1956, it was Stu Miller, Ben Flowers, and myself for Murray Dixon and Herm Wehmeyer.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Lane had came in, Trader Lane, and he started trading the whole ball club.
Yeah. He did.
I think he traded almost every guy away from there except Stan Musial, and I think he wanted to trade him, and Stan refused to go.
Yeah. All right. Mayo Smith managed you in Philadelphia.
Yes. Quite a guy. Yes. A very, very nice guy, and I thought he did an excellent job with the ball club he had. Mayo was a very good manager, I thought.
Let me ask this. Do you think even though Lane liked to trade people like mad, do you imagine that your trade was in part due to the injured knee?
Well, it could possibly be. When I got traded, of course, was the 11th of May, and I had thrown one shutout, and I had one victory. I was 1-0, my record at the time. And I can remember at the time, there was a lot of turmoil on the ball club because we knew the trades were being brewed.
Yep.
And so there was a lot of turmoil on the ball club.
Mm-hmm. All right, you stayed with Philadelphia in 57.
56 and 57 I spent in Philadelphia then.
And then before the 58 season, you went to Cincinnati. Was that a trade?
That was a trade. They traded Wally Post and I, who was a favorite in Cincinnati.
Sure was.
And I can remember at the time Wally said to me, he said, I've spent some time here now, you can spend some time here at home. Wally Post was from a little town of St. Mary's, Ohio, which is about 60 miles from here.
I know.
Yes.
All right, and there you, in Cincinnati, you
for
had...
just the 1 year, from 1958.
And you had two managers, Tebbets and Dykes.
Yes.
How were they?
They were excellent men. We just didn't win for Bertie Tebbets. It was a year, I'll never forget it. In the spring, when the season started, it just rained and rained and rained, and we didn't get to play. And finally, we had all the doubleheaders stacked up in front of us in July and August and September. And we didn't do very well. And I think, I'm not sure whether Bertie quit or whether he was fired or what.
Yeah.
Jimmy Dykes was the coach at the time. And I can remember him telling us, he said, go out and play ball, guys. Which we did, and we wound up doing pretty good under Jimmy Dykes.
You had winning percentage under Jimmy.
Because we had all those doubleheaders to play, and we won a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now we'll move on. We got things to come back to, but In 59, you're over in Pittsburgh.
All right.
How'd you get there? Trade, sale, or
at
what?
At the end of the 1958 season, of course, my record was only 8-7 mm-hmm. with Cincinnati.
Well, and, yeah, you're right.
Yes, and I had an injury all that summer and could not pitch as well as I wanted to, but that's one of those things, again, in the game of baseball. It was nothing with my arm or nothing. It was a physical thing, but it was nothing to do with my arm. I never had a day in the game of baseball that I couldn't throw a ball.
Good.
But I got traded to Pittsburgh, and possibly it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened in my baseball life.
I can believe it.
Yes. There was three of us traded for four. Smokey Burgess, Don Hulk, and myself for Frank Thomas, who had hit 30 or 35 home runs that year for Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Frank Thomas, Jim Pendleton, Johnny Powers, and Whammy Douglas was the trade.
Pittsburgh got the better of that deal.
We feel like we had the benefit.
Because you three became keys in the 60 pennant.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yes. And Danny Murtaugh.
Excellent man, a ball player's manager.
I thought so.
He just put you out there. If somebody needed to be corrected and disciplined, Danny did.
He knew how to.
If you didn't do anything that shouldn't be wrong, or was wrong, he left you alone.
Good.
Go out there and play as hard as you can play, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
No matter whether you did or bad, good or bad, it was always the same. As long as you gave the effort.
Everybody speaks well of Danny. Yep. Now then, let's go to May 26th, 1959.
Yes, and of course I had just been traded over to Pittsburgh.
Had you recently arrived there?
Well, that's to start that season.
Yeah, okay.
In fact...
So it's only the second month of the
We were all new with Pittsburgh at the time, mm-hmm. and we were in Milwaukee. In fact, early that morning, I got up in Pittsburgh about 6 o'clock in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and we flew to Milwaukee for a night game in Milwaukee,
mm-hmm.
and on top of it, I had the flu.
Oh, no.
Yes, I sure did. Well, anyway, I remember I didn't feel good, but in about the middle of the afternoon, I had a hamburger and a milkshake, and I headed for the ballpark, mm-hmm. not feeling good. I intended to pitch,
yeah.
no matter what.
Yeah.
And we get out there, and Danny held the meeting, and before the ball game, of how we were going to hit or pitch and defense against the Milwaukee Ball Club,
mm-hmm.
a clubhouse meeting before the game. Well, I'm conducting the meeting, how I'm going to pitch these guys,
mm-hmm.
and evidently I got on the old thing of pitching high and tight and low and away. And I can remember at the end of that meeting, it broke it up, Don Hoke spoke up and he said, Harvey said, if you pitch those guys that way, you're going to pitch a no-hitter. This was before the ball game now. And with that, it broke up the meeting. We all laughed and said, the heck with it, let's go. We went out there and got into the ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
you were against Lou Burdett.
Lou Burdett, again, yeah. who's the man that I beat in my first ball game in the major leagues.
Yeah.
And we got into the ball game, and of course, I had the no-hitter going, and there was no doubt about it. I felt lousy. I sucked on throat lozenges the whole ball game, so I wouldn't cough while I was out there on the mound.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of a rainy, stormy night. You didn't know whether he was going to play. You didn't know whether he was going to get rained out. There was lightning in the background and everything. It was a weird night. And the game kept going on and on, and I knew I had the no-hitter.
Yeah.
And of course,
when did you begin to really be conscious of it?
Well, I was conscious of it all the way.
Yeah.
In fact, before that, one time against Philadelphia, I went to the ninth inning with a no-hitter. And Richie Ashman came up and broke it up for me to lead off the ninth inning.
Yeah.
So I'd been through this thing before.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I did not try for the no-hitter. I just kept right on going and just one up, two up, three up, and down they went all through till the ninth inning. And I said, I've been this close before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go for it. Now the score is nothing to nothing, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only inning of that ball game that I really went to try to throw a no-hitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave it my all at that
time.
And
you did. And you got it.
And we got him out in the ninth inning. And, of course, we didn't score. So we keep on going.
Yeah.
And it was clear in every inning, as I would, from the seventh inning on, every time I'd appear on the field, either going to the mound or to the bat or wherever, mm-hmm. the people would stand and cheer me.
Sure.
The hometown.
I know it.
And it made me feel pretty good.
Should hope.
That these people, and sometime late in the ball game, I came to bat, and I can remember Lubert, or Del Crandall was the catcher, and he says to me, he says, Harvey says, you got a pretty good ball game going. He didn't say the magic word. He just said that. And of course, I said, I guess I have. And we kept on going. And every inning, I walk in and out. And there's the big scoreboard right up there in front of me.
You in the face.
You can see exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it went into the 13th inning. And the first batter up for Milwaukee in the 13th inning was Felix Mantilla. And he hit the most routine ground ball to third base that you would ever want to Don Hoke. He had so much time that he picked the ball up, looked at the seams, and got the ball just right, and threw it in the dirt at first base.
Yeah,
and Nelson didn't handle the ball, so the spell was broken with that man right there.
The perfect game is broken.
The perfect game.
And with it, the spell, but well, it's still a no hitter. Yeah.
I didn't know that I had done something nobody else had ever done.
Oh, my, yes.
No, I didn't know that. I knew that I had a no hitter. But I was never a stat man, you know, that worried about stuff like that. I knew that I'd had a no hitter, but it did not affect my pitching as far as that's concerned. Mm-hmm. The next man was Eddie Matthews. He sacrificed Mantilla to second base, and I threw Eddie out at first. The next man was Hank Aaron. We walked him intentionally to set up for a force out or a double play or whatever. And the next man up was Joe Adcock.
You had handled him four times.
Pretty good, yes. And with the second pitch to him, I got a slider a little bit up and out over the plate. It wasn't a bad pitch. It wasn't a good pitch. It was just
good enough that Joe
was good enough, and you have to give him credit. He didn't try to pull the ball.
Mm-hmm.
He went with it and hit it over the right center field fence as a right-handed batter.
Yeah.
Now the score wound up 1-0.
Yeah. Here, he passed somebody on the
here is what happened. Felix Mantilla, who was on second base, rounded third and scored. Hank Aaron was on first. He ran down and touched second base and turned around and ran back across the pitcher's mound. He knew they only needed one run to win.
Right.
In the meantime, Adcock had ran around second base, and the umpires ruled that he'd passed Aaron on the bases, and that's why the score wound up 1-0 instead of 3-0.
Yep, I know it.
But 2 years ago, I found out almost the impossible thing. Bob Buell was a pitcher on the Milwaukee Braves pitching staff at that time. He said, I stood in center field with the binoculars and relayed every pitch that you threw to the hitters. And they still didn't get a hit, and they knew every pitch was coming.
That's incredible.
He relayed them off of the catcher to a guy sitting next to him who had a towel on his shoulder.
Yeah.
If it was a fastball, they didn't move it.
Mm-hmm.
If it was anything else, they moved the towel.
I can't believe that.
Every pitch they knew was coming.
Because I've talked to so many guys who said, we beat so-and-so because they were
calling the pitches.
Calling the pitches. Like two of them have told me, Joe Sewell and someone else, that in the 1920 World Series against Brooklyn, when Bernie Grimes, the old spitballer, was pitching, Johnny Rawlings at second base would always, I believe it was Rawlings, would always reach down and get a handful of dirt if it was going to be a spitter. They picked that up and they beat him. And years later he told Bernie and says, oh, I knew you were getting something. Anyway, I listened to that whole game of yours, and It was a thrill, I tell you, to listen to it, and it was a sad moment when that ball went over the fence, because your guys had lots of chances to win it. I think you got 13 hits.
12 hits, I think we had, yes.
Off of Burdette. Were there any close plays there? I mean, was anybody thrown out at the plate that could have been the winning run?
There was a base running mistake made by Roman Mejias. I think he was on first base and a base hit, and he hesitated rounding second base, going to third, and I think he got thrown out. Yeah. But the biggest thing is, remember I told you it was a stormy night?
Yeah.
Bob Skinner hit a ball in the right field. Mm-hmm. It was out of the ballpark. Henry Aaron went back to the fence and stood there and put his hands down. A gust of wind came up and blew it back in the ballpark, and Aaron caught it.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yes. But the strangest thing of all to me, there was only about two real tough plays from our side.
Yeah.
I think it was Johnny Logan hit a real hot scooter at Dick Schofield at shortstop. Though Schofield was playing shortstop and Dick wasn't. I do not know at this time why.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, another man was missing from our lineup at that time, and I didn't realize it until later. Roberto Clemente did not play in that ball game.
That could have made a difference.
It sure could have. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, I think there was a ball hit pretty well to center field, and Bill Verdon hauled down easily. There was no trouble. And I think there was a line drive by Matthews to Rocky Nelson at first base. All the rest of them were the most routine. There was no running, diving catches or nothing. It seemed so easy some nights.
Isn't that so?
Yes.
And you can see, because there are guys who didn't even belong in the major leagues, practically, who on a certain day pitch a no-hitter. Bobo Holloman, for instance, and directors like that.
I think he pitched a no-hitter the first ball game
he went in. Yeah, he practically didn't win another game.
Two or three more ball games after that, I believe.
Well, that was a great moment, and it's one that will remain in baseball history, Harvey. Somebody might someday pitch 13 or more hitless innings or perfect innings, but hasn't happened yet.
Well, it's just one of those things. The situation has to be right. Usually a team has a run or so or something, and so the opportunity has to be there for the fellow to be able to do it.
It'll be very rare to have a scoreless game into the 13th, 14th inning. It's happened, of course.
Yes.
Johnny Vandermeer tells me that in his two straight no-hitters, there were only, in the two games together, there were only about two plays that were really tough and close. One, he knocked down a liner and chased it and just got it to first base in time. But those things just happen sometimes.
That's what makes our game of baseball so great.
Sure.
You never know what can happen.
All right. Now, in 1960, you really put it together.
As a team.
As a team.
As a team.
When did you begin, the Pirates as a team, begin to feel that you had it that year?
Well, believe it or not, I have this feeling today that my 12-inning perfect game brought us together as a group.
Could well be.
We kidded and agitated one another from that day on. They always had the thing about me that I was cocky and which was not true. But we kidded one another the rest of the time, and I think this carried on into the next year.
Must have.
And we were the loosest bunch of ball players you ever saw.
And you had a manager that helped you be that.
Danny Murtaugh was just a part of it. He just overlooked all the things. And when we went out there and played, we put out on the field.
Yeah.
And that's where it counted. In fact, Danny didn't have to go after guys. Our own players would go after one another.
That's
if we thought somebody didn't quite hustle enough after the ball, two or three of the players would go after the guy.
That's what
and
you need.
This was the thing that the 1960 Pirates had.
Great. Now, we overlooked one thing in 59, and that was the remarkable season that Roy Face had.
I can remember that very well. In fact, I can remember the ball game that he got beat it was the old Coliseum in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I cannot remember the exact situation, but I remember there was a man on second base, Now, Roy had 17 wins and no losses, I believe, at the time.
That's right.
And the routine ground ball found the hole between third and short.
Yeah.
And it scored the guy from second base as the run that beat Roy. And then, of course, he won one ball game after that and made him an 18-1 season.
Yeah, I think he holds the record for the most wins from the start of the season without a loss at 17.
Right.
Johnny Allen had 15 for Cleveland one year. And he was obviously a very, very strong figure in your winning in... '60, because he had 24 saves, which in those days was a heck of a lot of saves.
Elroy, yeah, sure, they've changed the save situation since then, yes. But Elroy might possibly and could be the best relief pitcher I ever saw.
It's entirely possible.
He was tremendous, and of course he was one of the first guys that threw the forkball.
That's right.
That started becoming so popular. Today they call it the split-fingered fastball and all those things. It's the same pitch, thrown at different velocities, is the difference.
But now, with Roger Craig promoting it, half the pitchers in the majors are trying the split-fingered.
Yes, and some can throw it and some can't.
Right.
And you wonder how many of those balls get hit out of the ballpark that was the split-fingered fastball that nobody says anything about.
Yeah. Now then, let's look at that 60 series. That was one of the most fantastic series that we've ever had. You guys are outscored 55-27, get beat 16-3, 10-0, 12-0, but you still hung in there and took that last one in a slugfest, where you beat them at their own game.
This is the 1960 Pirates. That's the way we played all year, the exact way. We had a bunch of guys that would not quit.
Mm-hmm.
They never knew when they were beaten. And, of course, if you don't give up, you got a chance of winning.
Indeed.
And that's exactly what happened in the 1960 series. We laughed on the days that they kicked the tar out of
us. Oh, yeah, that's all you can do.
We laughed about it.
It's good that you did.
That's better than pouting about it because it helped us for the next...
Actually, your spirits could remain better than if you got beat 2-1 or 3-2.
Yes.
Because you knew you were out of it, so just relax.
That's
and
right.
Come back the next day.
The game was gone, and we just got ready for the next day.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you beat them in game 5-2, and Elroy came in and finished it.
Yes.
And then you came back in and got the win in the
seventh
crucial
game. With the
Mazeroski
home run, yes.
Now, that's the most spectacular finish any World Series has ever had. It's the only time that a World Series has ended on the last pitch being a home run.
Right. And I can remember it very well. Of course, to start that ninth inning, I don't remember the exact way it was. I don't know whether I think we were leading by one run going into the
ninth inning. You were leading 9-7.
9-7.
They tied it up.
Well, they tied it up. I remember Bob Friend started the inning, the ninth inning, and I was warming up in the bullpen, and this is why I cannot remember all of it.
Yeah.
But I do remember when I came in, there was a man on first and third and nobody out. And I looked at the plate, and there stood Maris. Over there stood Mantle. And following him stood Barra, and following him was Scowling.
Good grief.
And with the game tied up, within that close, that's a tough situation.
You know it.
Well, here was it's the only time in my life I ever got nervous on a mound.
With reason.
Well, I said, I can't pitch this way, so I've got to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
I stood out there, I laughed at myself, I cussed myself out. I did anything. It must have took me 5 minutes. And I'm looking up at home plate, and all the time I'm trying to get this nervousness off of me, Maris is standing up there grinding the bat, trying to look like sawdust was coming out of it. He wanted to hit.
Yeah.
And the more I could delay him, the better it was going to be for me.
Yep.
Well, actually, they hit each waste pitch that I threw in
You're
that
kidding.
Inning. I can remember the first pitch to Maris. was off the plate inside. I think he hit my first pitch, I believe, intentionally off of the plate about 6-8 inches at least. He swung and popped it up over home plate. And Smokey Burgess, I believe, was the catcher at the time.
Yeah.
He caught it. And Hal Smith hit the home run earlier, but I believe Smokey was the catcher. Yeah.
I don't have the box score here. That's in another book.
Well, anyway,
I'm sure you're right.
Maris popped up, and the next man up was Yogi Berra. The very same thing to him. I wasted a pitch inside.
Yeah.
A waste pitch, and he swung and hit a one hop. He hit the ball hard.
Yeah.
On a one hop to Rocky Nelson at first base. Now, why to this day, I do not know. Rocky Nelson didn't throw to second base and back to first for the double play. I was running over to cover first base.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Rocky. He's looking at third base because the runner was on third.
Yeah.
And as I look, there he is. I take it back. I've got ahead of my story. Mantle batted second.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Mantle batted before you.
Yeah.
I wasted a pitch to Mantle outside and off of the plate low, and he was on one knee and hit the ball for a single over Mazeroski's head. That put the tying run at home. That tied the game.
That tied the game.
With that bloop single. Excuse me. Then came the Berra as the batter, which he hit the ground ball to Nelson at first base. And with one out, like I say, I couldn't figure why he didn't go to second base and back to first base for the double play. But he was looking at the man on third. And as Rocky runs up and touched first base for the out there on Berra, Mantle must have been confused too, because here he comes sliding back into first base. Sliding.
You're kidding.
Coming from second base.
Yeah.
He's sliding into second base. He was safe. So there's only two out yet.
Yeah.
With a man on first and third. And the next batter was Bill Scourin. And I throw a waste pitch inside to Bill Scourin, and he hit a ground ball to Dick Grote at short.
Mm-hmm.
For the third out.
Can you beat that?
I think I threw four pitches to four hitters in
all
that night. All pitches that were waste pitches.
Well, if you had wound up losing that game, you would really think that Nelson blew it.
But yes, it sure would.
Final analysis, it just made the victory more sensational.
It sure did,
yeah.
Yes.
I can't remember whether Maz hit the first pitch or the second. Second.
Mm-hmm. Second pitch, I can remember it very well. I was sitting on the bench, and my turn at bat, I was going to be Maz was the eighth hitter.
That's right.
I'm the second hitter, and he's going to hit for me.
Sure.
Because Mizell is warming up in the bullpen.
Yeah.
As I'm sitting there on the bench, I see the first pitch to Maz. And he started to go for it and laid off of it. He didn't swing. He started and stopped his swing. Ralph Terry was pitching.
Mm-hmm.
And on the next pitch was about 6 inches lower. I would say about chest high.
Just right.
Just right for Mazeroski. And he swung. And with the crack of the bat, I knew the ball was a home run.
Yep.
I told the guys on the bench beside me, I said, I've thrown enough of them out of here, that's gone. And sure enough, when that thing sailed over the wall, Pittsburgh went wild.
Wild moment.
Yep. Yes.
Great memories. Great memories. Now then, let's move on to 61, and the Pirates dropped from first to sixth place.
We didn't do worth a darn. We tried the same things the next year that we'd done the year before, and things didn't work out.
It's happened so many times. You see it all the time now.
Didn't work out. No matter what we tried, did not work.
Well, the Red Sox are in that situation right now.
They sure are.
The Mets started off that way, but they're gathering some steam now.
Yes.
Well, that's part of baseball. Like you say, if we knew what was going to happen all the time, nobody would be out there watching.
We sure couldn't explain it. We almost had the same personnel and everything.
Yeah. Now then, in 63, you got converted to a reliever primarily.
Yes.
How'd you like that?
It was something new to me, and I didn't mind trying it because as time went on, it became tougher and tougher for me to go nine innings.
Yeah.
And, of course, the bullpen wasn't used in those days like
same
it is
way.
Today.
Oh, no.
No, I could get a lot of games. I could get five innings, six innings, but that wasn't enough. In those days, they wanted more.
They wanted eight or nine.
So I was glad to go to the bullpen.
Yeah.
And it was quite an adjustment. And the toughest thing for me, I was the only left-hander in the bullpen, and my arm got very, very tired. Not that I couldn't throw a baseball.
Yeah.
I could throw the ball, but not with the stuff on it because my arm had not been used to that throwing day after day. Being the only left-hander down there, I was up every day for look, for show, for use.
More than once, probably.
Oh, I've been up. I was up as high as 7-8 times in a day, and then they say, "Hey, we didn't use you today. We got you for tomorrow."
Oh boy!
And you don't say no.
No, you don't. Now you went to Baltimore.
Yes.
Was that a trade?
That was a yes, and I cannot think of the name of the young ball player Pittsburgh got for me from Baltimore.
Doesn't matter. I can find it in the book.
It was a young player, and I cannot remember the name. I don't know whether Pittsburgh got any cash out of it or whether it was a straight deal or what it was.
All right.
But I enjoyed it very much in Baltimore.
We found Hank Bauer in
Minnesota. Yes. And, of course, in spring training those years when I was with the Cardinals, and he was with the Yankees, we used to play against one another quite often in spring training.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew one another pretty good.
Well, you had a good season for him with 10 saves. You got into 89-plus innings, and 10 saves back in those days was pretty many.
Not too bad.
No.
Not too bad.
And Baltimore finished third that year and third the next year, too.
Yes.
All right. Now, you were in the 65 season, you were 40 years old.
Yes, I was. And I did not do very good. And it was not because of my age, as far as I'm concerned. In spring training of 1965, I pitched an inning in spring training.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, of my age, might have had something to do with it.
Yeah.
I pitched an inning. This was early in spring training. The very next day, they called on me to pitch two more innings in relief.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember after the first inning, I went and tell Hank and Harry Burkeen, who was the pitching coach, I said, "My arm feels very heavy, but I said, I think I can continue to pitch."
Mm-hmm.
And I went back out there for the next inning and pitched the inning. But after that, my arm was never the same that year.
Yeah.
Now, I could throw a ball, I had no pain, but I did not get the stuff going again.
Ball didn't do what you wanted it to.
No, it sure didn't.
That's about like Glenn Wright told me after he banged up a shoulder off-season playing handball.
Mm-hmm.
Said after I recovered finally, operation and so forth, I'd throw just as hard. That is, I go through the same motion, but it took the ball a lot longer to get there.
Yes, that's about the way it was.
Yeah. Well, you had 14 seasons. That's a far more than average career, even with the war cutting you short at the beginning and everything. And you've got to have a lot of good memories. Other than the no-hitter and the no-hitter for 13 innings and the 60 World Series, can you think of any other particular thrill that you had in baseball?
Well, the thrill for me was being able to put on a Major League Baseball uniform. It's something I think that most youngsters would love to be able to do.
And especially back in those years.
In those years, yes. Remember, there was only 16 Major League ball clubs.
Plus, there weren't so many pro sports.
That's right. There wasn't near as much. There was more emphasis on the major leagues at that time. And I think at that time, the Cardinals, when I first started out, had 22 farm clubs.
That's right.
And the Dodgers had 26 farm clubs.
Yeah.
And when you think about coming up through and beating all those guys out and reaching that. That's the thrill of being in the game of baseball. And the idea that you could play the game that you love and entertain people and get paid for it.
Yep.
What more pleasure out of life could you have?
I can't say.
It's just one of the greatest pleasures of all. But the other day in Pittsburgh, they named me to their all-time baseball team for the city, along with Ralph Kiner, Hannes Wagner, Pie Trainer, Manny Sanguin, Willie Stargell,
Clemente,
and Paul Wehner.
Oh, sure.
I got on a team, Elroy Face and Vernon Law were the other pitchers. They had a right-handed pitcher, a left-handed pitcher was me, and Elroy was the relief. And I got named to that pitcher in Pittsburgh.
That's great.
That, to me, is really an elite
real thrill.
And I don't know. I'm sure there were left-handed pitchers. In fact, there was one fellow won 200 ball games for him, and named me the best left-handed pitcher in Pittsburgh history.
You earned it, and particularly in those special moments of the 13 perfect innings and tying down. They hadn't had you in 60, they wouldn't have won the World Series.
Well, you like to think of that way, but you never know.
Well, I say it. Any regrets?
Possibly my only regret, as far as pitching, my regret is that you couldn't win more and contribute more. That's one. But I have this satisfaction that every time I went out there, I gave it everything I had.
I'm sure.
Do you want iced tea?
Okay.
The only regrets that I have is when I first came to the major leagues, I had a good fastball, a good curveball, and a change of pace. And I learned to throw that slider, of course. And I let the slider get carried away. I threw too many sliders and lost my good curveball.
That's bad.
Even though that I could adjust the slider from a very small slider to a great big slider, I still lost the effectiveness of the curveball from throwing too many sliders.
I can see how that had happened. Yeah. Too bad. All right. Now, any of the players that you played with on those various teams that you'd want to say anything about, great ones or near greats or anything that you think of?
Well, the only thing I can say, I played with a lot of great ball players.
You did indeed.
Yes. To start off with, there was Stan Musial in St. Louis, and of course I watched him very and of course with his stance and everything he did, looked like he did everything wrong at the plate,
but
he could hit the ball.
Yeah.
So after my career, when I became a coach, I decided right then that I would not try to change anybody because he was doing something that looked wrong. If he could accomplish something with it, leave him alone.
Yep.
Do not change him and make him into a mold. Leave him alone.
That was wise.
Yes, and so as these times I was with Robin Roberts and I could get Clemente and all those fellas you could go down through, and of course how many great ones that I played against.
Sure.
And one thing that each one of them had was the intensity with which they played the game.
Yes.
And they all enjoyed it. You could see them. Of course, when you're having good years, it's very easy to enjoy it so much. It fits in.
Yeah.
But they all had that great intensity, the desire to excel. That's what they had.
Yeah. Now, do you think ball players today have the same intensity?
I think as a group? As a group, maybe not. But there are certain ball players today.
Oh.
I say this about today's ball player. Today's ball player is bigger. He's stronger.
Yeah.
He's better taught.
Yep.
Than we ever were.
Yep.
But they get there so fast that they don't get a chance to learn their trade as well before they get there.
You're so right. And because of the night ball and travel across country, they don't have the same togetherness and they don't have near as much fun.
I don't believe they enjoy the game as much as we do. Well, because of the salaries today, they have the money to do things on their own, right, which we didn't. We had to do things as a group.
Yep.
But they did it, can do anything they wish today. Yep. They have the money, and the closeness is not there. But still, like I say, today's ball player is a lot better athlete overall than what we were.
On top of which, fielders have got gloves that can't miss a ball.
That's exactly right. There's been an improvement.
Yeah.
I have in here my first ball glove that I ever owned as a kid. A man gave
me. Funny looking little thing, isn't it?
It's just a little bit bigger than my hand.
That's right.
And you had to catch the ball in your hand.
With two hands.
With two hands.
Yes.
And
that's
we watch them today, and I can understand why the guys use one hand. They really don't need the two hands.
Once the ball hits that glove,
it just folds in there, yeah, and it's there. So a lot of old ideas are great and were great, mm-hmm, but some of the new ones are also okay.
That's right. All right. Now, in your day, do you remember any particular plays that were great or funny or unusual?
One of the greatest plays I ever saw, an outfielder named Bill Verdon, made it in Forbes Field in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. I don't know who the hitter was, I don't know who the team was, but somebody hit a ball, it was fairly high, it was hit well off the left center field fence in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm, which had to probably be around 10, 15, 20 feet, somewhere around that area, and the wall was about 15 feet high or better. And I can see Bill Verdon going after that ball. The vines are on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
He ran right up the wall with his spikes, with those vines on it. He was able to run up, and he must have been 10 feet in the air, and it looked to us like from the dugout that he caught the ball. But instead of coming down with the ball and just throwing it, he turned around and fired a strike into third base and got the runner going to third base.
You're
for
kidding.
A triple. Now, we didn't know. I saw the umpire was out there on the play. He was in left center field, and he called the safe call. As soon as Bill came down with that ball, he called safe. When Bill Verdon came in, I asked him, I said, "Bill, did you catch that ball?" He said, "No." He said, "I short hopped it off of the wall."
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the greatest things I've ever, it just looked like
and he caught the runner.
And Bill, he put that glove up there and the ball bounced off the wall, mm-hmm, and he caught it, looked like it, and the umpire was sharp enough.
That's good.
To be able to make that call. And I've got to say this in fairness to the umpires today, I think the instant replay is great. It shows how many times the umpires are right.
Which is 99 point something.
Yes, and then there's some of them that are very questionable yet because the angle of the camera does not give you the full view,
same view that, the umpire
that you need. And yeah, I think rather than a detriment to the umpire, I think it's a plus. And so they miss one once in a while.
We all do.
Well, it's the game of baseball.
Right.
There's nothing perfect.
That's, nope, not even after those 13 innings you brought
out. There is nothing perfect.
Real good, Harvey. Any funny guys in your teammates?
Oh, there was always a lot of funny guys around. In the general, the thing that I enjoyed as much as anything was the camaraderie with the guys in general. You knew the guys that you could kid with. You knew the guys to leave alone. And just the idea of being around them every day and what guys you could joke with. And so there's nobody really stands out as far as that's concerned to me.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of fun with a lot of them.
I'm sure. Were you married during your baseball days?
At the start, no. Yeah. I got married in 1955 to my wife, Marcia. Uh-huh. And then she traveled with me for 10 years till 1965, and that was through Baltimore.
Yeah.
And she'd had enough, but we had our third little one at that time, mm-hmm. and she stayed home from then on while I was coaching the rest of the time.
When she started staying home, well, that was tough.
It was a change of life. And we've got to give the wives credit.
That's
for
right.
A baseball wife to stay married to a baseball player
right.
is a very, very tough situation, especially if you have little ones.
That's
now,
right.
if you don't have little ones, it's not near as tough.
No.
But if you have little ones, it's a very tough situation.
They all say that the wives are the unsung heroes of baseball.
They sure, it takes a special person
yep.
for a wife to be married to and stay married to
That's
a
right.
baseball player.
You're so right, Harvey. So, what do you feel about in general about baseball today? What do you think about free agency?
Well, all I know is, I don't know what exactly is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know this, that they mashed us when I was playing. They were not fair to us.
I know it.
And we were hurt. Then I think it swung around. And the ball players were unfair to the owners. I don't know whether the owners brought this on themselves or not.
They did.
So it went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in a swing back where they're going to swing and meet halfway.
Back to a happy medium.
I think that's the thing to do. I cannot see these 4 or 5 years. I say today, if a guy has a good year like a Tim Raines did last year, give him that $1 million.
That's right.
For a year.
But 1 year.
For a year.
So right.
Not 4 or 5 years. That, to me, was the biggest mistake.
All and the old-timers say that the long-term, guaranteed, no-trade, no-cut contract.
It handcuffs the owners. They can't do what they want to do.
And removes incentives.
That's exactly
yeah.
what happens. It takes away from the game of baseball. But I still say these guys today, they're not overpaid. Because television generates a lot of money, but the biggest fault is the long-term contract.
That's right. What about artificial surfaces? Do you have any feelings?
Yes, I think it's a great thing, the artificial surface. I enjoyed, in all my playing time, I played on grass fields. And it was excellent. And still, you have a nostalgia about it,
mm-hmm.
that the old fields are great. But for television and
yep.
things today, the world spins around money today.
Yep.
I think the artificial surface has its place today when the game is scheduled.
Yep.
They're able to play the game
almost
unless
always.
It plays
hard rain at the time.
It stays raining.
And you get truer bounces.
Truer bounces. I don't know whether it probably has something to do with base stealing today. I think they're
so.
Able to run
but
faster on it.
Yeah.
And of course, there you get back to the better athletes again, too.
Yeah.
And the more scientific, like I say, they've been taught more than what we were
yeah.
taught.
Yeah.
So everything today, to me, I believe in the artificial surface because of this, the money situation. And the television revenue that comes in, I think the artificial surface is a place for it.
Give me a comment on the designated hitter.
The designated hitter has its good points and bad points also.
Mm-hmm.
The designated hitter, of course, gives another ball player a chance to play and produce.
So.
One player extra, usually.
Yeah.
Against the designated hitter, it takes away from the maneuvering of your managerial part of
that's
it.
True.
Yes, and that's going to have its effects in the long term on your pitching.
Yep.
How many games are completed and how many are not completed and so forth. So I think it's unfair to baseball to have one league have it one way
that's right.
and the other league have
that's
it
right.
the other way.
It's even unfair to have 14 teams in one league and 12 in the other.
Yes.
But that's not as much unfair
as the DH
in only one
plays,
league.
Plays a big difference in the way the game is played.
Now, let's go back to, instead of talking about you as a pitcher, let's talk about you as a hitter. How about your 4 home runs?
I had five home
Did
runs.
You?
Somehow or another, one of them's got lost in
I'll
the record.
I'll be darned. The book shows
yes.
four, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I had three on the roof in St. Louis. I had one in the upper deck in Pittsburgh.
Gee whiz.
And I had one in the sun deck in Cincinnati. And that adds up to five
yeah.
to me. But the book says four.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know which one they lost.
I found the book wrong on a few other things, too.
But anyway, that was my... And I don't think I miscounted, because when you only hit five in a career...
You can remember.
You can remember it pretty well.
That's right.
But I'll say this. I enjoyed hitting, and I wasn't a good hitter, but I could slap the ball around. I'd get the bat on the ball a little bit. I could not hit a left-handed pitcher with 10 bats. Kurt Simmons, it was impossible. I say a brick wall could not have kept me in against Kurt Simmons. But I did enjoy it. In fact, the one year in 1954, 53, I believe it was, I was doing four jobs for the St. Louis Cardinals. I started and won 20 and lost 9.
Mm-hmm.
I relieved. I don't know what my record was in relief.
Relieved,
it didn't matter.
You didn't have any wins or losses.
Well, I relieved a few times in there. I pinch ran, and I pinch hit.
Yeah, you hit .289 that season.
Yes, and I enjoyed it.
28 safe hits and a one home run, says, might have been two.
I think there was another year there I had 30 some. I was thinking I had 30 some base hits.
No, not according to this.
Not according to that.
28 was your best.
That was the best.
24 you had, 21, 18, and so forth.
I know what it was. Stanky had the bet that the pitching staff wouldn't get 30 base hits, I think, for the whole year, the whole pitching staff. So needless to say, we won that.
Yeah, good for you. Which city did you enjoy most?
I enjoyed every town that I played in and went to.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have to say possibly St. Louis and Pittsburgh stand out to me. And, of course, a lot of things happened to me in Milwaukee also.
Mm-hmm.
But the towns that I enjoyed playing in overall more, like I said, I enjoyed them all. But the two that stand out is Pittsburgh and St. Louis.
Great. So if you had it all to do over again, you would try to do it pretty much the same way.
I wouldn't change a whole lot, no. The only thing, I think you'd be a little smarter and do things a little bit different,
yeah.
But there's no second chances in our game,
no.
So you go with what you did.
That's just, we learn from doing, but you can't go back and do it over again.
Yeah, it's the old thing of second guessing.
That's right. It's great fun, but it doesn't change anything.
Right.
Harvey, I'm very happy to have had this chance to talk with you and find you here in good health and good spirits and remembering good things about baseball. I don't know, I guess they'll never put you in the Hall of Fame, but in a way you belong there with your unique achievement, and you're going to be remembered everywhere, that's for sure. I was in the in Cooperstown just last week and talking with Howard Talbot, the director. He agrees that there should be some separate categories there for, for one thing, for pitchers who throw no-hit games. Have a separate little section for them and some other divisions also, but it's not about to happen right now, I don't think. Anyway, you've got... your cherished memories, and nobody can take them away from you, and it's great, and I'm delighted to have had the chance to talk with you.
It's sure been my pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. So you went into coaching after 65.
Yes, at the end of 65, 1st of September, Baltimore traded me over to Milwaukee, or sold me to Milwaukee, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I refused. We just had the third little one. And my wife was in a very tough situation where he was born in Baltimore and he was just a young one. And I said, I cannot go traipsing on further. I know I'm at the end of my career. I just said, that's it. I quit.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home here and was getting organized, and I still wanted to be in baseball. So I was inquiring around about jobs, but at that, for that given time,
mm-hmm.
it was too much pressure. So, during the winter, I'm sitting here, I got a contract from the Kansas City Athletics. I flew out there to be a coach for the Kansas City Athletics. They were tossing it around. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about letting me coach with Vancouver, their AAA ball club. Mm-hmm. And I had another iron or so in the fire, and all at once the phone rings, and it's the New York Mets. Johnny Murphy was calling from the New York Mets. And my wife told me, she said, it's Johnny Murphy from the Mets. And I said to her, I said, now wouldn't that be strange if he wanted me as the pitching coach there? And that's exactly what he asked. And of course I said, now look, John, I said, I'd love to be the pitching coach for you, but I do have a couple of problems. I said, I have a contract laying here from the Kansas City Athletics, unsigned. Which is not a real big problem, but it's, yeah. I've, the same as, yeah. said yes. And I said, I still belong to Baltimore, because when I refused to go to Milwaukee, I reverted back to Baltimore.
Right.
So here's what he said to me. He said, you take care of Kansas City, we'll take care of Baltimore. So I called Kansas City, and I talked to Ed Lopat, who was the general manager. Yeah. And he says, Harv, he says, we don't stand in anybody bettering himself. If you want to go there, you go right ahead and go. Right. And that's how I wound up being the pitching coach of the New York Mets. And would you believe the pitching staff that I started off over there? Nolan Ryan, yeah. Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, Tug McGraw.
Oh, golly.
Was that fun? Yes.
Yeah, and certainly a challenge, and the way you brought all of them along, Nolan took a while to get enough control to be a winner. But
Nolan didn't run a pitch in New York, was the impression I got, because he came to me one day and he says, what do I have to do to get traded from this ball club? He's a country boy, and he didn't like the big city, and he wanted out of there.
Sure, he's from Alvin, Texas.
Yes, and I said to him, I said, there's no way you can get traded until you pitch. I said, you have to pitch, and then maybe something can be worked out. And, of course, later, it happened for him.
It did.
Yeah.
Well, that was a great staff.
And we had to leave when Western quit as manager at the end of the 67 season, and we all got fired. Whitey Herzog was the third base coach.
I'll be darned.
And he invited me to stay on with the Mets at that time, and I said, no, I'm going on to other places. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going on.
Yeah.
And Whitey stayed there, and that's where he became a front office man and eventually turned into the manager that he is today.
And that's something.
It sure is.
Yeah, I think he's the smartest man.
He's one of the best in baseball today.
Right. Absolutely. And will probably go down as in baseball history as one of the best in the 20th century.
He sure was.
He keeps everything up for the next few years.
Yep. He's done a tremendous job.
So how many years did you coach?
I coached from 1966. I started with the Mets. I am 1967 with the Mets. 1968, I went to the Pirates minor league system, which was a great experience. I loved it, working with their minor league pitchers.
Be rewarding.
Yes. In 1969, I coached with the Cincinnati Reds. In 1970, I went back to the Pittsburgh Pirates minor league system again and coached them again, which I enjoyed. Like I say, the money wasn't there, but it was enjoyable.
Yeah, that's right.
And then I was out, in 1971, I coached with the Boston Red Sox. And I enjoyed it up there. And my wife was getting kind of tired of living alone, and she says, I think you better stay home for a while. So I was home in 1972, 73, and 74. And in 1975, Frank Robinson from the Cleveland Indians, he'd just been named manager, and he called and said, would you be my pitching coach? And I said something to my wife, and she says, go for it. So I went back with the Cleveland Indians for 75, 76, 77, 78. And when I left there, I started coaching with the Pittsburgh Pirates in 79 and was lucky enough to get on the 1979 World Series champions again.
That's great.
Which was wonderful, and I stayed there until 1984. And I said, I got fired and retired.
Well, that made for quite a career.
I had an enjoyable career the whole way.
All right, listen, now,